Hey, JB here, the Wolf of Wall Street in the Wolf's Den. I have an awesome guest today. Someone I have tremendous respect for, ex-military, world-class entrepreneur, building a $100 million business as we speak in manufacturing, e-commerce. Guys, the real deal. Colin Wayne. He's going to be on in a moment. Before we get started, a couple of quick words here. I want to just focus on one point that's going to come up in this podcast. We talk about this idea of manifesting success and the secret and the law of attraction and things like that. And I just want everyone, when we get to that point, I want you to really focus in on what I say. I qualify his statements about using the law of attraction to succeed. Because here's the deal. You know, I'm a believer in the law of attraction. Yes, it does work. It is powerful, but it only works if it's followed up with massive action on a daily basis. So intention without action is just that, intention. It results in no advances, no gains in the real world. So just remember, I want you to really focus in on this idea that the law of attraction, you know, this idea you could just sit home on your couch and somehow, you know, attract money and success into your life. I mean, good freaking luck trying to make money like that. I mean, if you sit home on your couch praying for a bag of money to hit you on the head, you know, the only thing that'll end up is an eviction notice in your mailbox, right? They'll be towing away your car, your wife or your husband's banging the next door neighbor, and you're like, where's my check? Where's my check? Money doesn't show up in your mailbox. You have to go out and get it. You have to earn it. You got to go out and work. Always starts up here between your ears. And then we go out and make it real in the world through strategy. So when we get to that point, just focusing on what I'm saying along with Colin, and we go back and forth, and it really gets very clear about how you go out and use the law of attraction and manifestation in the right way. All right? So with that, I'm not going to go off on any more tangents here. I want to get right to Colin. Just quickly, a word from our awesome sponsors, and then we'll be right back into the podcast. All right, listen, you don't need to tell me that running a business is hard work. But if you're still using QuickBooks and spreadsheets, chances are that you're making it far more difficult than it needs to be. That's why it is time to upgrade now to NetSuite by Oracle. Stop paying for multiple systems. Don't give you the information you need when you need it. And ditch all those spreadsheets and old outdated software programs that you've outgrown and just upgrade now. NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. Bottom line, it gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. It's everything you need all in one place. Best of all, NetSuite is for everyone. Whether your business is doing $1 million or $100 million a year, you're going to save a ton of money and a ton of time as well with NetSuite. In fact, over 21,000 companies are using NetSuite right now, so you'll be in great company right alongside them. So let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/wolf. That's netsuite.com/wolf. Schedule your free product tour right now. It's netsuite.com/wolf. That's netsuite.com/wolf. All right, Colin, thanks for coming on. Awesome to have you.
It's an honor to be here, brother.
First of all, massive respect for you being a veteran and everything, keeping the country safe and defending us. And I've always had massive respect for people that are really going to put themselves in harm's way. When were you in the military? What years? How long?
Yeah, so I joined in September of 2006, and then I got medically discharged after getting injured in Afghanistan, March of 2013.
How'd you get injured?
So I was on my third tour. I was in the Paktika province, and May 3rd, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was working out in the gym, and a rocket impacted about 3.5 feet from me. And from the grace of God, I survived. I blacked out. I got thrown to the ground. It was kind of like what you'd see in a movie. It was two Blackhawks flew in. They picked me up. They carried two medics. They came into the door, and they carried me out of the burning building. And it was pitch black. So it was fob. So a really, really small base. It was about the size of two football fields for perspective. And we were right on the Pakistan border. So you've got mountain ranges all the way around us. Think of it like a horseshoe. And we're down in the base.
It reminds you of this movie I just saw, Outpost. Did you see this?
I haven't. No.
It's on Apple TV. It's like one of the top movies right now with Clint Eastwood's son. And it's about this barracks, like in the really dangerous part of Afghanistan. It's like in the base of a mountain surrounded by the enemy. Is that really what it was like?
It may have been my base. Who knows? It was called Bob Boris. It was dangerous enough where they shut down the base. So
it must be the same thing. It's because it's like exactly like what it's crazy. I mean, like they're sitting there like that. It's like sniper fire, like at any given moment, like they're running for their lives. Is that what you really lived through?
Yeah. So it was so they have fighting seasons, essentially. So a lot of the Taliban flock over to Pakistan. And because we were right on that border, fighting season comes early for me. Or at least for where we were in that province. And
what define fighting season? What's fighting season?
So great question. So fighting season is like anything that's not in winter, because the winters there in Afghanistan are extremely cold, like impassable mountains. So to get from one base to another, we always had to take a helicopter. And so we never when I was in Iraq, we would always take convoys anywhere we wanted to go. So I'd go from Basra up to Talil, up to Baghdad, up MSR Tampa. And then in Afghanistan, it was completely different because of the terrain. And so for us, we were always having to get picked up by Blackhawks because of all the mountains. So the same thing in like fighting seasons, the Taliban, they can't pass because it's impassable. Like it's ice, snow, and it's, you know, 2, 3, 4 feet just packed in at certain areas in Afghanistan. So when it hit spring, it's just about every day we were getting mortared or rocketed. And then we had our base got overran twice while I was there. So that's Taliban on our side of the wire. So that's like the size of two football. I mean, it was really, really small. We had about 80 people on the entire base.
Why were you there? What was the purpose of you being there?
So we were artillery base, call for fire for five other support bases. And then we also had a platoon of infantry.
So what was your specialty in the armed forces? Were you you Army, Navy, Marine? What was your?
So I was a military police staff sergeant, but I was cross trained into a couple of different job skills. So.
All right. So let's. Wow. I mean, just really, I'm glad that you're home and glad that you're safe, and everyone owes you a debt for that for sure. Do you feel like you accomplished anything that made it all make sense down there? Do you feel like you were doing something that was? That actually, I guess this is like when I watch some of these movies and you can't believe what you see. Listen, I know I had a movie made about me, but right. So like sometimes it makes it seem like the soldiers are there for no good reason. Is that true? Or is there usually a reason why the soldiers are there and that's just not an accurate portrayal, or is it true?
Just from my perspective, Iraq, I felt like we did some good. Afghanistan, I really didn't have a clue. Iraq, for instance, with what we were doing with my battalion, we were training other Iraqi police. So so that was kind of our overall mission, was just sure. What they call pit style training. So police transition training. So we were training their Iraqi police officers. So some of their higher commission officers in the Iraqi police forces, and training them on different, correct policing, I guess. So
got it. Yeah, sure. So I guess
in that case, I really don't know.
You're leaving something good behind, in a sense that you're leaving some knowledge behind, and it'd be a police force that could do their job in a way that would be, I guess, effective but compassionate, not overly violent, right? And not without unnecessary loss of life or harshness. But in Afghanistan, you didn't feel that way. You felt like, what are we doing here, right? I mean, it's like, right? I guess that's, how do you make sense of that? I mean, I guess you're conditioned to follow orders. You don't ask why. Is that just the chain of command? And mine is not to ask why, but to do or die, basically.
That's essentially it. For me, I never felt like fulfilled, but I will say this, like I volunteered for all tours. I was one of those kind of daredevils. I loved adventure. I do better under pressure, and, starting my business, I thrive under those very, very tight KPIs, hold myself accountable, and was always looking for kind of, adventure in general. both of my grandparents served. My brother, he served. He was a captain in the Army. And I enjoyed serving. So, yeah.
And do you feel that your years serving in the military set you up to succeed in business?
Absolutely. I think it plays a significant role. Those key military principles, those values that are instilled, a lot of, even like my leadership style is structured very similar. You know, we've got right at 100 employees now at my company, Redline Steel, and, you know, there's multiple layers. And taking away from like the military aspect, I went to different training schools because I made staff sergeant in 6 years, which it typically averages around 11 to 12, unless you're special forces. So I learned from people that I absolutely wouldn't want to be like, and you could take those negatives and apply that. And then we also had some incredible leadership that I was able to kind of embody that style of leadership. So I'm one of those guys, leaders that like to lead from the front. Like, I'm not above it. I like to know every facet of the business and really understand the entire organization. And then, you know, a part of that, like, is kind of embodying the rest of the leadership as it goes down to have that same type of mindset that we're not above it. We can go out there if it's needed. You know, Black Friday, Cyber Monday weekend, that week, the goal is to do over 10 million in revenue. So it's going to take whatever it takes for us to get those orders out. So I'll be out there packaging boxes and embodying with the staff members, because that's what it takes. So whatever it takes mentality.
What are those? Let's go back to, so you said like the values, the core values that you learned. So what are those core values? Let's say if you give me like, you know, the top three values that really guide, that you learned in the military that you now apply in the business world.
I would say my top one that I live by is just the word integrity. So doing what's right, even when nobody's looking. I actually had a sports nutrition company that I sold to a venture capital group in Texas. And that was the name of it, Integrity Driven Nutrition. And another one that comes to mind right off the bat is just selfless service. But I mean, those core seven values, loyalty, duty, honor, integrity, personal courage, selfless service. Those are your core values that I embody every single one of them and apply it to my daily life, my work life at Redline. So
tell me, give me a story about your years in the military, something that's really, that you think people would find interesting that actually relates directly to what you're doing now. Can you draw like a line from an experience that you had back in the day that really, you know, you learned something from that allowed you to succeed in business, or at least deal with it, you know, in a way that was more empowering?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wasn't prepared for that, but the first thing that pops into my mind is my near death experience. I think that, you know, when you can look death in the face, I think that you can appreciate life so much more, and you can pivot multiple ways. One is you can kind of shell up and kind of detract anything the world has to throw at you. And kind of, you know, I feel like I've got forms of PTSD, and a lot of veterans that come back through the military, they do have forms of that, but I've been able to cope extremely well. For me, it's been being able to apply my mindset to whatever challenges in front of me. So whether that's like fitness modeling, I transitioned out of the military, even though I got blown up in the gym in Afghanistan by working out. And I turned that near-death experience into a career. And so I landed 50-plus magazine covers like Men's Fitness, Muscle and Fitness, Ironman. I was working with massive companies like Under Armour and Nike, and traveling the world to fitness expos. So the gym almost killed me, but it also I pivoted it. I changed the mindset where I'm going to make this. And I never let that stop me from kind of hitting those goals and putting those barriers in place. So I've got, I had to have lumbar block fusion surgery on my back, L1 through L3. Shrapnel went, okay.
Nice. I had my spine fused. I had my L4, L5, L5S1, I think. I had it fused back in 1995. Rods and screws. Did you have the rods and screws in there? Do you have metal rods there?
Not yet.
I got them. Yeah. don't get them so quick. So let me ask you a question. Unfortunately, I can't say that I was serving our country. I was chasing a freaking dog on the beach, and I took a bad twist, and it popped a disc. I like to say, how did it happen? Some child was burning in a car accident. I jumped in to save the child, and I pulled the child. With one hand, I lifted the car, but that's not what happened. I took a bad step on the beach. But, I'd love to tell it the other way. So, let me just going back to this accident. Was it the enemy's rocket came in and just like out of nowhere, just like blew up right 3 feet from you?
Yeah. So it was an irregular day. We usually got hit at the same time frame. I don't know why they call it NAIs, named area of interest. And we would get hit at similar times. And you start to pick up on patterns after a while, after you've been hit. And so, we were a blackout fob, meaning that we didn't, because it was so dangerous, we didn't like to have lights. It was at night. So I would typically work out at night. And we, from my knowledge, I don't remember being hit around that time period at night. So, it was different.
It like reminds you of that scene from Iron Man when like the rocket comes down, and he sees it's his own rocket, and he's like, uh-oh. And then it wasn't like that. How you just all of a sudden, bam, like out of nowhere,
Yeah, so we have what they call CRAM, and it's counter rocket artillery mortar. So these radar systems detect it, and then there's an early alert system, and they went off. But at that point, it's roulette. You know there's an incoming threat, but at that point, you don't know, you can't really do anything. So
you don't know where it's going to land.
It happened to land literally through the roof. I'll send you a few photos so you can
see
it.
But wow.
It's pretty crazy.
So that happened to you essentially. Is it an appreciation for life and sort of like enjoying each moment? Was that what you took away from it? Was it a fearlessness? What was it, like, the outcome of that for you personally?
I think it was a mindset pivot in the sense that I have so much more to live for, and I was living a little dangerous. I like to, I had my son. At that point, he was about 6 months old. And I had volunteered for all tours previous to that, but I'd never had that close of an incident. I did over 100 combat missions in Iraq, but ironically, I got blown up on my own base. So you can't plan on that. But at the same time, I put myself in that situation by constantly trying to volunteer and do things. So, I think that my mindset was just, look, Colin, like, don't be a hero. You've already you've served, and there's no point in putting yourself in those types of situations if you don't have to.
Sure. So tell me about your transition from being a fitness model to into the business world itself, where you started building a company. When did that actually occur? What was the year that you started?
So I officially January 6th of 2016 started the company Redline Steel, but the concept came into mind when I just initially just wanted to be a customer, but I knew something was missing. I was missing something internally. There was no inner peace.
What is Redline Steel exactly? What is it?
So we specialize in home decor made out of steel, but we also have like canvas and some other items, but traditionally like wall art decor. So something you would see on your front door, like, Smith's on a front door that's got it cut out, laser engraved, something like that. So we're the largest in the nation. 4 years, we've shipped over 5 million products, and we're on pace to hit over 100 million this year. So as a business.
Wow, that's amazing. So what was the inspiration? What was the moment that you came up with the idea?
So I mentioned my son, when I was in Afghanistan, he was 6 months old. Fast forward to 2015, he was 5 years old, and he loved baseball. At that time he was in T-ball. But I was working out at the gym with a colonel, Colonel Neely, and he showed me a piece that he got for his son. And it was really cool. It was this baseball player. He was swinging a bat like this, and you could see his son's name engraved in it. And it was just really – and so I wanted it for my son. I was like, oh, my God, that is so cool. And it's something that you can't go to, like, Walmart or Home Depot or whatever. And so initially I just wanted to be a customer. And so then it pivoted to I reached out to the guy that owns that local company and asked him if he could make my son one. And so he said, look, I'm backlogged about 10 to 12 weeks, but When I get caught up, I'll reach back out. And so I said, no problem. Just reach out. I'm not going anywhere. So 10 minutes later, no shit. Like, he reached out and said, oh my God, it's Colin Wayne. I didn't realize it was you. I can have it done for you this week. And so I said, okay, awesome. And it pivoted to, he wanted help with his business because he knew that I guess he'd done some research, saw that I'd been successful, but not in business, just success in general. They saw big house, nice cars, all kind of just random things. And
what
I think
was
he was looking for some help.
What was that success from, though? That came from the modeling?
From the fitness modeling.
The fitness modeling. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Got so, it pivoted. So it turned from a customer into being a consultant, and then from a consultant making an offer on his business. So I wanted to just be a partner with him. So I made him an offer. I wanted 51% of his company. I put strict terms on myself because I'm a firm believer that you put your money where your mouth is. So I said, I'll do 6 times revenue of what you did last fiscal year. I'll finance the growth, but I'll own the asset under another corporation. And then I will not take a salary or distribution for 12 months. And if I don't do all of those things, then I'll give you back your company 100% after 12 months. And so it, you know, 600% growth guaranteed, any finance growth, 0% interest, no salary, no distribution for 12 months, just to show I'm committed. And he accepted.
What kind of revenue was he doing back then?
He was about 85,000 or so, but I probably shouldn't say that live, but I felt comfortable. Like, if I can't do, you know, over $500,000, I don't want to be a part of this business. It's not worth my time. So I have no problem taking that risk and gamble to make it easy and more comfortable for him to put myself accountable. And that was my self accountability. You've got 12 months. You put this timestamp in place. Now it's time to execute. And so, the day he was supposed to sign the paperwork, he backed out. He wanted to renegotiate. And so I told him that, you know, we had a deal. And so he wished me the best of luck and said, look, I'm not going to show up. This is my final offer. And we never came to terms. So he's doing his own thing. And now I own Redline 100%.
Ah, okay. So you didn't close on the deal. So you started Redline from scratch.
Yes, sir.
And so explain to me, so it's like metal, like that's like a statuette, like something like this almost, like, but like made out of, what exactly does Redline, if you can show me?
Yes, sure. So this is like a product that we're releasing tomorrow for $2 Tuesday. So I own the website $2tuesday.com. And this is like a product we're releasing just in time for Halloween. So we powder coat them so you can put it outside or inside. Perfect, like holiday gifts. Like, we do a lot during fourth quarter, but custom monograms is our specialty, but we also do stock items as well.
What percentage of your business is done during the fourth quarter?
It's about a 4-time multiple consistent, and this is our fourth quarter. So but there's a strategy difference. So first quarter through third quarter is heavy acquisition. It's mostly through like a break-even strategy and then monetizing through upsells, post-purchase. And then for us, fourth quarter, we're basically remarket retention about 50%, and then acquisition, but consumers are willing to pay a premium and buy for other people. So we can actually acquire people and still monetize extremely heavy on higher ticket items.
So what are some of the higher ticket items that you would sell in the fourth quarter? Like, I mean, meaning starting like after the day of after Thanksgiving, is that what you mean? So that last 5 weeks of the year, I did phenomenal. I tell you, I understand. I do information products, and that, wow, what a last year! Like, it just blew up. It was amazing, you know. So I know the power of that last 5 weeks of the year. It's pretty cool. It actually lasted to like even through the first week of January almost. It kept going for a little while, right? It kind of keeps going, right?
Yes.
So what are the higher ticket items? What are some of the higher ticket items you sell?
Fire pits, customizable fire pits where you can put your name in it. So we have like a couple different versions of that. And then we have a flag that's kind of like a hero flagship product. It's powder coated 3 different colors, takes us around 3 hours to make. But that one's, you know, our highest price point item's about $400. So it's nothing significant, mm-hmm. but it's still reasonable. So there's nothing on our website above $400. So
Wow, that's great. So tell me about some of the early struggles that you have with the business. I'm sure you had some fulfillment struggles. It's, you know, working with metal, it can't be easy, right? It's not for everybody. I wouldn't even know where to start myself. I've never been in a business like that with an actual manufacturing product. It takes a certain expertise. So how was that in the beginning, and what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced?
So my biggest challenge was my business plan shifted immediately. When that guy did not sign the paperwork at my attorney's office the day we were supposed to sign, instantly it shifted. I knew nothing about manufacturing, absolutely nothing. So true story, I bought my plasma table the next day, but I had no place to put it. So I went and had to find a location. So the first challenge for me was knowing that I needed to be, I had to find a warehouse, and I didn't want long terms. I didn't want 3 years, 5 year terms. And so that was one of my first challenges, because we've scaled from 5,000 square feet to 110,000 square feet all in 2.5 years. So under 3 years. So negotiating terms with landlords were extremely challenging, because commercial space, they don't want to do short-term leases, and I don't blame them. And so I had to get creative with my deals. So that was challenge one. Challenge two was I didn't know manufacturing. And so when they delivered my plasma table and I was able to secure a short-term lease.
What's a plasma table?
Yeah, so great question. A plasma table, let me see if I can find a pen that's retractable. Yeah, so think of a plasma table like this pen, and this pen is not retracted, kind of the kerf and geometry of what it can cut with a plasma. With a laser, think of it like it's retracted now, and I can do so much more tight tolerances. And it's also very fast, it's more efficient. Like this is about as efficient non-retracted as a plasma table. So it's extremely slow. It's not a great tool, but it was a starting point for us. And I was proud of it, still am. And now we've got 5 lasers, fully automated, lights out, shuttle tables, load, unload. You can come grab a forklift in the morning, have 30 sheets already pre-cut. And so we've automated the entire process. But that was a big challenge for me, is just trying to find talent, but still with limited resources. So it's mm-hmm. been levels to it. And we're still sure. 4 years old as a company, trying to grow leaps and bounds. So it's honestly like every week is a new challenge. So keeping up with the incoming orders, outgoing, balancing the two, hiring. And then one of my biggest things was my biggest investment was hiring a recruiting firm. I didn't really know how to find the right staff, the right executive team. And so that was a great, probably one of my best decisions was to bring in higher talent, not where I am today, but higher where I want to go. And so that's definitely helped offset.
What were some of the key hires that you made that you think were instrumental to your success?
People that have, one, they're a lot more expensive typically, and rightfully so. And it was hard to justify, because cash flow on a consistent basis is challenging as you're growing, investing into
sure.
your business, buying all the assets, and not having massive lines of credit. We don't have.
But you're in a capital intensive business, because I mean, you have equipment, you have inventory. So it's a real business. It's not like just like information. I sell information. It's pretty simple. You create it. It doesn't cost anything to ship. You have a real real operation going there. Right. How many? 100 employees? So what was the most important hire that you made that you think that was real instrumental hire?
My first one was a plant manager who had about 35 years of experience, older gentleman. His name's Gary. Incredible find. We found him through a recruiting agency. And then we just hired a new vice president who's got fortunately for us, he was laid off because of coronavirus, and he's got MBA from Harvard, and he's got a lot of experience. So he was a former executive at another company, and we were able to bring him on. And so he just started with us about 2 months ago. So
great.
And we've got a lot of other talent as well. I don't want to leave them out, but yeah.
And where do you, so what was the key growth engine? Was online marketing, e-commerce?
So yes, I would say acquisition at scale, and then knowing how to nurture that list and get them into multiple tier buckets. So we've got like a rewards platform. And so now we have customers that we call Redline Elite. And those are customers. Some of those have ordered 200, 300 different times, several times a day. And this isn't something that you need to like order every day, but people do. We've embodied a culture. Our demographic, I think getting in touch with exactly who that fit is extremely important.
Who is that fit?
Women, 35, 65 plus, Christian conservative, married homeowners. And so that's really when you refine it. And so, and then in terms of marketing, we segment them into different buckets. So prospect acquisition by...
I don't know why that made me laugh because I just didn't see it. I like, wow. Like I just was completely wrong. I thought it was going to be a different consumer. Okay, so 35 to 65 conservative. Wow, okay, great. Interesting. And is there a certain, so is that a certain part of the country that they, is it global or is it mostly U.S. based?
Only U.S. currently.
Only U.S. And what, and do you have any certain parts of the country that you do really well in and other parts that you don't do so well in? Or is it everywhere?
Depending on the product line, we'll geofence. But for the most part, our hero acquisition products are not specific to categories of focus where it's like coastal or, you know, desert or some type of product. What I love about our products is we can create anything that comes to our mind. So I wouldn't say that we have region specific. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of customers all over the nation because we have over a million customers now. So but we're not targeting specifically this area hits hard. Let's continue to hit that. There is a longer term strategy behind it that we will, but.
Is it mostly done through Facebook ads or Google, or are you doing affiliate marketing?
Everything, everything. So we've had well over a billion impressions so far. And but Facebook ads is heavy into that side. So we've spent over $13 million over the last 3 years. And so Facebook's our heavy driving hitter. So top of funnel traffic is pushed through the Facebook side. And then we have omni-channel marketing to pick up all the remarket retention, affiliate platforms, driving traffic. And then we're just about to start getting into influencer play. We do a lot outside of the box as well. So we partner with large nonprofits, nonprofits like Habitat for Humanity that also have celebrity-based focus. I'm a humanitarian at heart and love to just put people over profit. And so for me, we've been able to kind of find distribution outlets at a zero cost and be able to give back. So I'm creating a product for nonprofits, donating 100% of the profit back. They're using celebrities to outreach and distribute. So they're driving traffic to my website. And then we're basically manufacturing, drop shipping that product for them. So then we've got endorsements through celebrities. And then the back end is like 2 weeks ago, we were in People Magazine twice, Us Weekly, TMZ, Fox News. And so it just continues to be a ripple effect.
Got it. So there's a lot of sort of long-term seeds you're planting. So you're, these strategic alliances are, so you're giving away all the profits, but then you're getting the customers for the long term. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Absolutely.
Great.
And I'm perfectly okay with that. I would rather do that than to pay Mark, you know, from Facebook. So
do you do a lot of Facebook advertising though?
Yeah. We, like I said, we've spent $13 million in the last 3 years just on Facebook ads alone. That's about 80% of our market ad spend only goes to them.
So How about Google? Are you doing stuff on Google as well or not as much?
We do. Yes. Google, YouTube, Google search, shopping, you know, the retention side. So it's a great platform. The challenge is it's only going to be as scalable as you're who's searching those key terms, or else it gets extremely expensive. So there's caps to what you can do at scale for profitability. And so for us, Facebook is great for driving traffic, but the consumer interest and the intent may not be as high. And so your return on ad spend isn't going to be near as efficient as YouTube and Google. Or Google in particular. YouTube's great. It's great for like impressions and you can get in front of a lot of people extremely cheap. It can be a little bit more challenging on the CPC side, depending on your key interest, if you're going broad or extremely specific, because your cost per click is going to be relatively a lot more expensive than to run ads natively through Facebook. But it is a blended channel. And so we look at you know, I'd say 80% of our revenues are our market ad spends to Facebook and Instagram to drive traffic. It's also great for just, you know, DPA ads, remarket retention ads. And then the other channels are, since they're pixeled, we're now serving them across so many different channels as well.
Do you feel that in your business, you consider yourself to be, if you were to define like what your core strengths are, besides just, you know, being a good manager, is it marketing a core, one of your core strengths, would you say?
I would say what offsets me from any of my competitors, which my competitors, they're no bigger than 15, 20,000 square feet. And they're, you know, a lot, but I would say humanizing our brand and getting in front of the camera, live streams on a consistent basis, and connecting with our avatar, almost as what you'd see through YouTubers that have been around a long time. We've embodied kind of a culture where people know exactly what we're doing, and they get excited about new product releases. There's a private group that's not a top-tier reward platform, but called Redline VIP Group. And that's our customer focus group. Companies pay millions of dollars to have a focus group before we launch products. We'll test it in the VIP group, get consumer feedback, and then figure out if we want to put paid traffic behind it. And we'll also test like color variations. We'll test new products, new t-shirts that come out. We're testing before we pay. And they're really our focus group. Now they're embodied to feel like, holy shit. Like he picked my color that I want. He picked the product that I wanted. I'm going to support that because I really wanted it. And he picked what I wanted. So we're listening. It doesn't matter what I think looks good. We're really in touch with our consumer.
How do you come up with ideas for new products? Is there some sort of, is there like a think tank? Just who's the ideas person? Is it you? You just come up with ideas for new products? Or do you ask your customer base, hey, what would you want me to make? Is it that, you know, customer's the best idea? So?
Yes, 100%. We listen and we ask. We're not afraid to ask for, you know, like we launch $2 Tuesday. Every Tuesday we release a product, only $2. And we do that to collect data through SMS. And so that's been a massive prospect scale for us. So we could drive traffic. And, you know, on Tuesdays, it's incredible. When we do a text message, we'll have 10,000, 12,000 people live within, you know, a couple of minutes on our website. So we're flooding the traffic to our website. Now it's more of like a top of funnel strategy just for traffic in general to get there so we can remarket. It's not extremely profitable, but when you look past the bigger picture, it helps us tremendously. So I think it's just, as a marketer, I've gotten more comfortable being uncomfortable and kind of trusting the process and looking at things holistically different. So I'll look at market ad spend to top line revenue, and then I'll look at key metrics per channel. So I'll look at key indicators to know that this should be scaling, this shouldn't be scaling, we should turn that off. But I'm okay with being less return on ad spend over on this channel, knowing that my top line is where it needs to be on a market ad spend. So I'm not afraid to scale. Like I'm sure just like you, I've got a Centurion Black card. So it's literally, I've got no caps with my media buyers. As long as we're hitting metrics, we just need to keep pushing. And as long as we're not backlogged on the fulfillment distribution side.
What's the biggest error that you've made so far in this journey with this business? Is there anything you said, wow, this is what a lesson? I mean, I think that, you know, the mistakes, I make a lot of them myself. I always learn from them, hopefully. What are the biggest mistakes, errors that you've made here that have given you great, you know, sort of, you know, lessons that have allowed you to come back even stronger?
Lessons learned for me is not biting off more than I can chew and trying to not let down my consumers. The first 3 years as a business, we were delinquent on Christmas gifts. And so now I look like I'm the Grinch. And so that was extremely hard, especially because I told you my core value is integrity. Not having redundancies in place on certain key pieces of equipment, because I simply just don't know. And we didn't have staffing in the past that could really think, if this goes down, what are my redundancies?
Sure.
And so now we're building an extremely strong foundation. And so I feel so much more comfortable going into this year's, you know, top busy season than I've ever felt. But I would say just It's hard to decline an ad that's performing extremely well, to know that this could be a challenge to get this out the door. So if I'm being very vulnerable and open, that's been a challenge, is just mentally saying, okay, even though I'm going to make a lot of money here, I've got to turn it off or I've got to decline it, because of that balance. Because we can have more orders coming in than our, what we can carry and what we can actually ship, even in, you know, 100,000 square feet. So,
So I think when it comes to that notion of having integrity, I don't think it's about whether you deliver or not. Obviously, you want to deliver. I think it's more was your intention to deliver. In other words, you can't, if you make a mistake and things don't go your way, you can't fault yourself and beat yourself up. I think the problem is when people do things knowing they have no way to deliver and they're just doing it to try to generate some money and noise. But it sounds like that you had every intention of doing what you said you were going to do. Just things didn't work out the way. So I don't think that really affects your integrity at all. What do you think about that? You agree with that?
100%. I mentioned redundancies. We had a major piece of equipment fail in 2018. We had the best physical year we had ever had for fourth quarter, and even better than 2019, because I had PTSD from the year before, and it almost put me into bankruptcy. We ended up being delinquent on a lot of orders and deferring over $3.2 million into the next physical year because of that. And because of that, we couldn't run ads. And so from January to March of 2019, we couldn't run anything because we were too backlogged. It took us that long to get all those orders fulfilled. We had a major piece of equipment fail, and we had just ordered about 8 months before, had a warranty, everything, and it was from Switzerland. So they had to fly a tech in. They had to fix the problem. It was a perfect storm. We ended up having a backup. We bought one. It was like $70,000. Not a big deal, but we brought it in, ended up being the CFM on it for the air. Ended up getting water and oil into our laser heads. And so then it actually ruined one of my laser heads. So it was the absolute perfect storm. And I'm not experienced in manufacturing. So, you know, I was moving everything with a purpose to make sure we can get it done. And it was just, you buy this, you're waiting on a tech. Nope, can't have that fixed. We got to ship this part in. Well, what now? So now I got to go buy, I'm going to go buy a redundancy, like some type of screw compressor with the built-in dryer. But the amount of, because we're 40-foot ceilings, so it's got to go up and all the way over to the lasers. We didn't account for the moisture and any type of things in the line. And anyways, we've fixed that problem. We've got three. We're way over capacity where we are now. But that's been one of our biggest challenges, is in the past not having those redundancies, because I simply just didn't know. And then under-delivering and feeling like mentally I let them down was more, you know, because I was working 15, 16 hours a day. That's all I did. And I literally bought an RV and lived here for 3 months because I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to wait.
Where do you live, by the way? Where's your home? What part of the country?
Alabama. So I'm in Huntsville, North Alabama. So we're about an hour and a half from Nashville.
Okay. And where's your fat and your factories in that area?
Yes, it's same town, Huntsville, Alabama.
But you literally bought an RV to sleep on, like basically sleep at the factory?
Because I didn't want to drive 25 minutes home, 25 minutes back. So it was worth it to me to not waste that hour.
Do you think that the people that know you from when you were younger, when you were, let's say, a teenager or in your early 20s, would be surprised at where you are right now? Or was someone like, were you like destined for greatness and to have high standards? Or was this something that developed later in life? That guy, oh, he always was good. We always knew Colin. He was always going to somehow land on his feet. Was that who you were or no?
I'd say it's mixed, because I would be shocked looking back to know where I'm at right now. But I was always driven. I was always hungry. I dropped out of high school at 16 to join the military, no degree. So, you know, who knows what people thought back then, that, you know, he's crazy to join the military. That's probably all he's going to do is do the military. So it's hard to say, but I did do well in sports. And then I did well in the military. And as soon as I pivoted into the fitness modeling thing, that took off. And you know, I was making $30,000, $40,000 a month doing that. And so the lifestyle began to change. And that was, you know, that was 8 years ago. So it's been a very consistent pattern of continued success and growth. So I wouldn't say people are too shocked now of where I'm at.
Do you have a specific goal or vision in mind of where you want this to end up in the next 5 years? What are you looking to accomplish here?
Yeah, I love that. So the vision for Redline is that we're going to be a $1 billion company. And I've prophesied this from the beginning. I've been documenting. We have thousands of hours. And the ultimate vision is to exit for $1 billion. We're in a complete blue ocean. And so they're 100% we're going to make it. I've been prophesying this for my 5,000 square foot warehouse. You know, vlogging, I've hired production companies to come in and just continue to film the entire journey. I want to be like the first docuseries that's ongoing with Netflix. And so that's ultimately, I want to be that one entrepreneur that doesn't show this is where I'm at currently, but this is the process. This is what took me there. And opening up about like, these are the setbacks.
Did you ever have any times, I was thinking, where you're like, shut the cameras off. Like, you ever feel like there were some moments like when you were having the struggles and thinking like you're going back, like, kill the lights. Like, you ever have those moments?
No, I open it. I'm extremely open to criticism, and I'm vulnerable in the sense that I'd rather just be as transparent, not fake, just this is what it is. And so thousands of hours of documented footage. So that's really the goal. And, you know, we had, when we first started, we had a kitchen oven that we welded hot rolled steel into, and 24 inch parts. We would push it into this homemade kitchen oven, powder coat it. We'd have to take it out about an hour and a half later, flip the part around because heat rises so that it continued to bake. So it was, but even when I was there, like literally like talking about this is going to be a $1 billion company, and there hasn't ever been this. There's no doubt in my mind that we're going to make that happen. And even to this day, and prophesying to just about 6 months from now, this is what's going to happen. Because I'm a firm believer in law of attraction and manifesting exactly what you want to come into your life. And that's exactly what's happening. So like, if you look at timestamps of what I recorded to what actually took place, I mean, it would shock you almost down to like 30 days of what I was talking about in the future.
So I think that, you know, one of the things about the law of attraction and manifestation is it's a very dangerous thing to talk about without really getting into it. Because I think a lot of people misunderstand what it really is. Because I believe 1,000%, yes, we attract things into our life. We manifest success. I do it all the time. I've always done that. The problem is that manifestation starts in your mind, but then requires massive action and perseverance in the real world. All you're doing when you're manifesting success is you are highlighting to your own brain what things are important, what things need to be moved towards, what things do you need to try to attract, and you end up moving towards those. You move towards what you focus on. Just say, okay, this is the things I need to focus on right now. So to me, I don't look at the law of attraction or manifestation as some woo-woo thing that can't be explained. I think it's really easy to explain exactly how it works. Like, you become really clear on what you want in life, and you make it so vivid in your own mind that it opens up, okay, well, if this is what I want, what do I then have to do to get what I want? What should I be focusing on? What direction should I be going in? And then the problem is, for many people, is that's where they fall down. They are willing to take the action. Are they going to move the RV in next to their office and sleep there because they don't want to cannibalize 25 minutes a day? Are they willing to go through the hell and the high water of almost going bankrupt? Most people won't do that. They'll stop. And I can appreciate it firsthand that, you know, I started a new business recently, which is going really well, but there's a million problems like every single day. Like, what the heck? Like, how could this be going so wrong when it's such a great idea? And as you're growing, and, you know, it's almost like people are ordering you. I can't fill the orders. Like, I'm in the recruiting business. I have a recruiting company, right? And I supply salespeople. And I've quickly realized that I have orders that are so big that I'm trying to find more salespeople, because like, it's like there's all these unintended consequences that happen because there's a lot of lazy people in the world. So I'm like, well, I can train as many salespeople as I want. Yeah, it's true. But, you know, in this post-COVID world, some really weird shit going on. People think, wait, mean, I have to work outside my house. And actually, I really have to work. It's not much going to get a hand down. Like, no, you really got to work and you got to be great or you're out. So it's interesting that I think most people don't realize that even in the greatest businesses, you're on the tightrope every second of like trying not to fall. But then eventually, listen, each year it gets better and better because you have a base and you have a cash flow that develops and you're smart. You're having repeat business, right? But there are massive headaches. And I think with the law of attraction, what happens is that stage one is create the vision, talk about it, make it real. But step two, which is also not that hard, let me start moving towards what I want, what I'm visualizing. It's phase three. What do you do when the shit goes wrong and you don't see it working? Most people back off or try to play small or don't make those pivots. Like, you know, I always say I'm a master pivoter. You use the word pivot probably 20 times. I'm a master pivoter because if you don't, you die. And as a small business, the biggest advantage you have in the world is the ability to pivot quickly. Large companies can't. Small companies can. What say you about that? Do you agree?
I agree 100%. And being mobile in a sense that everything that we hire is internally. We don't outsource anything. So as we're scaling, we can continue to scale with the company, scale the organization. I would also add that like personal accountability is on up there. Like you have to hold yourself accountable to the sense that, you know, and then internal goals to ensure that by this date, I'm going to hit this and I'm not going to stop until I do. And then, so like last year, my goal was to have over a million orders. We didn't hit that goal. And so I was about 220,000 orders shy. And we ended out the year, we did well, but I was upset at myself. I swear to God, I was really upset that we didn't hit it, like pretty hard on myself because I was talking about it. I was doing live streams. Hey, we're going to celebrate together. We're going to do this. And we're going to finish out strong. This is my goal this year. And I didn't hit it. And so that's my personal accountability. I owned it, but I was upset that we weren't at that milestone where we were.
Let me give you a different take on that though. See, so I think that's healthy. And I don't see, to me, when a goal is being set correctly, you're stretching yourself above what you really think is the top and you're stretching. You have this really robust target. Like the problem with most people in life that don't succeed is not that they set their goals too high and miss them. The problem with most people is they set their goals too low and they hit them. So I always say, like, you know, you want to stretch your goals. You don't want to like say, oh, you know, I'm going to hit my goal. It's mediocrity. What does that do? I want to set a goal. I heard James Cameron, the famous director of Titanic and Avatar, greatest thing he ever said, saying, you know, what's the secret to your success? He's like, you know, when I do something, you know, I'm thinking this is got to be a billion dollar gross, a $2 billion gross. Because if I fall halfway short, I'm still doing better than everybody else. So he's aiming really high. So I think that, you know, I always say the difference between vision and goals is that your vision is where your emotional attachment is and your goals tell you whether or not you're heading in the right direction or wrong direction. And you have all these, you know, short-term, intermediate-term and long-term goals that essentially connect to your long-term vision for the future. So the idea is, yeah, if you set a goal for a million and you did 100,000, okay, well, yeah, that's failure, so to speak, right? Well, you know, but if you set a goal for a million and it's a stretch goal and you get to 800 and something thousand, I say, okay, fair enough. I'm doing things right. What can I change? What do I got to do? But you're moving in the right direction of your vision. And the emotional attachment is there in your vision. So the idea is not to get yourself too upset. It's good to be hard on yourself, but only if it doesn't disempower you. You know what I mean? Some people get disempowered where they beat themselves up and start developing limiting beliefs about their own ability to succeed and so forth. So you got to be a little bit careful with the self, you know, the self-flagellation.
Yeah, it's just my... You know, I'm not satisfied. And I think that's, you know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs, especially at certain levels, it's hard. Like I don't celebrate the wins enough. It's like literally hit a million. When I did finally, I teared up and I'm not an emotional guy. So that was, but then the next day it was a brand new day. And that day,
and
I actually like
the problem.
I 10X'd it. I 5X'd it, to be honest. I said, I can't wait to hit 5 million. I didn't go to 10 million, but like what about 2 million? What about 3 million? Like, it's not even like in my mind, it just jumped to another crazy limit.
That's the
and
point.
So if you get 24 hours,
that's the problem. So if you get too negative or so if you set a goal for a million and you reach it, you buy yourself what, 24 hours of happiness? And then it's like, oh, what's next? So the point is not, so I really try not to get, and listen, I'm not perfect, of course I do, but I try to temper my beating myself up or overly celebrating things that happen, because what I'm really trying to be emotionally attached to is the long-term outcome and not get too emotionally, I'm using my short-term successes or failures more as, am I heading in the right direction or the wrong direction? Do I need to really fundamentally change what I'm doing here? Is it not working? Because the idea might be sound, but maybe the way I'm going about it is just not right. The marketing strategy is a bit off. The messaging is not right. Maybe my sales process has too many steps, not enough steps. Maybe I'm trying to get too much money up front. Maybe I'm not playing the overall long-term value of the client enough. These are all the things that you can change in your model. And based on that, you know, you get radically different results. So I think the idea is, listen, I think with you, it doesn't really matter because you are an expert at not allowing your disappointments to become you. The biggest mistake people make is they become their disappointments. They become their letdowns versus allowing those to make you even stronger and you go forward. And if that's the case, then you're pretty much safe either way. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. And So I guess the long-term vision for me is to exit for a billion. And that's been the goal since day one. Then I'm never going to settle though. Like it's on to the next thing, but I already have that mapped out in my mind. So I already know exactly once I exit, and you said 5 years, I said 5 to 7 years. So that was my time cap. As soon as you said that, I was like, yeah, that's where I am. I want to exit and then create my own, venture capital incubator. I want it to be a little bit different. So I want it to be where my avatar alignment is going to be the exact same. So women 35, 65 plus, and then own entities that align with that. And because data is becoming more and more expensive every single year. So I know if I'm targeting the same avatar through all of these different companies, I can now, you know, company A, I can feed into company M and vice versa into all different aspects of the business. And so as long as I have a strong marketing team and kind of, you know, I want to hire the best freaking people. I want to be the dumbest guy in the room, really invest into that side and then use all of that data in tandem with the other organizations. And I just love building stuff from concept to reality and segmenting. Like I've built all of my emails. I've got probably 800 plus segmented emails based on consumer behavior, purchase history, customer win backs, immediate post-purchase, like taking it a step further of like, you know, everybody gets abandoned cart series emails. What about dynamic abandoned cart series for my top selling product, showing customers that are actually customers holding the exact same product that you wanted to go and buy. So like really segmenting that to get higher conversion rates. And that's ultimately what it takes when you're scaling rapidly without venture capital, cash flow, is to think outside of the box. And I'm just constantly trying to move that needle every single day.
What are your thoughts about, I was thinking about aggressively going out there and trying to help people that are ex-military get them jobs for my recruitment agency. So I have all these companies that are paying really good salaries. They're looking for salespeople. And I find ex-military people do typically really well because they want to put in, you know, sales can be difficult, but they're willing to go out there and do the grunt work. Grunt work in a bad way. I mean, they're willing to put that, you know, whatever it might be, whether it's going out there into the field or calling on the phone. They typically are not scared of rejection after getting shot at for a few years. It seems so bad, I guess, in the general scheme of things for them. So what do you think about recruiting from the military? Have you done that yourself at all?
Absolutely. Yes. That's kind of like veterans preference in my case. I prefer to hire military. We just hired a new executive, another one. He's prior military, served 9 years and just got out not too long ago, but has a lot of experience. And I prefer that just because of those core principles, the way that they can show up and deliver every single day. They're not complacent. They're willing to listen, but also they could take both sides from a leadership standpoint. They're not, they don't have to be the only person that can give. I think they understand where it comes from, like, I don't know, the leadership side, where they can take criticism, but they can also give it back in the right ability. You know, we've been trained extremely well, especially higher you get military, you're going through all kind of different schools to teach you those core principles of leadership. So I prefer to.
Is it a problem right now for people that are getting out of the military to get jobs? How is that transition? Is it typically difficult for people, or is it easy with a military, with an honorable discharge?
You know, I would say that, I'd say it's mixed on both. I would say that it's hard on veterans in itself for the simple fact that they're used to structure and they're used to getting up at 4:30 every single day. You know, when you look at the amount of homeless veterans out there, that's majority. And because they've gotten off of that, this is what I have to live for. They're used to somebody telling you at 4:30 a.m. we're doing PT. You're going to eat at this time. You're going to go to bed, not necessarily go to bed, but like, you've got accountability in place and they're going to hold you accountable. When that's taken away. And I think, you know, if you've done 20 years and you're retired, that's different, right? You've matured, but I'm talking about
people that come do a tour, right? 20s, early 20s, mid 20s, right? They go in, they come out, and they're used to like everyone telling them what to do every second of the day. And suddenly they have too much time in their hands and no structure and discipline. And they find it challenging to operate, being more, I guess, with, you know, more self-directed what they should be doing versus someone telling them what to do. Is that a big problem?
Exactly. I believe that it is. I think that it is a big challenge. And people resort back to alcohol and drugs, and it's kind of their way of combating. And I've got nobody else to tell me and hold me accountable to do something. I don't have to get up the next day. So yeah, I think that that is a challenge for the younger, guys getting, you know, deploying, coming back, doing one term to less than 6 years, and then trying to find an area in the workforce.
Interesting. Well, I'm definitely, maybe we should talk at that. I want to really help. I have the ability to give them free training, to get them trained up in a very high level skill wise for sales, and get them jobs at great companies, you know, where they can really have structure. And I've been thinking about that for a while. I just think that I've always done really well. Whenever I hired ex-military, I've done really well with it, you know?
Yeah. And I prefer it. Like I said, I had a documentary come out, ClickFunnels, they did it, and they just released it yesterday, ironically. But at the end of the video, I'll send it to you. It's really neat. I was talking about, along with my long-term vision of being a billion-dollar company, I want to build a military compound, essentially 350 acres, and be able to be a rehabilitation center for like a veterans outreach, also like a second chance. I think that America in itself has made it extremely challenging for those that have felonies to get back into the workforce. And I think we have failed as a society. You know, they are forced to go and do that to provide for their family now. You've made it, I can't even go work at Walmart or McDonald's because crazy. I have four felonies from selling drugs when I was 18 years old. Like, right. It's insane. Ridiculous. You serve your time. Now it's time to move on past that. So I think that, I think we felt.
It's a very big difference. Yeah, it's a very big difference between, you know, someone that's had violence and done things versus these nonviolent drug offenders. There's so many of them. And I know, I believe, you know, that actually, it's funny, as part of when I originally started this company, that was the start of it, of this recruiting salespeople, was convicted felons. Someone approached me with the idea. It ended up pivoting to regular people. And I actually called him recently, this guy, because I wanted to start saying, hey, you know what, now that I'm established, I have all these companies that are hiring hundreds of people from me, I could definitely take some percentage of convicted felons. And also, yes, I think it's a huge issue. I think both of convicted felons and the military, of making sure that people transition back and get the support they need. You know, I think it's otherwise, in the case of, you know, ex-felons, recidivism is massive. And the whole thing's based on employment. If they get a job, they don't go back. If they do, you know, You know, so it's problematic, you know. So what's in terms of this? So now you're doing also masterminds, right? You just started your first mastermind. Tell me about your mastermind and exactly what type of people are coming to that, what it consists of.
Yeah, so I founded the company called Founders Mastery. And so it's a weekend mastermind. Every quarter we meet up. I love just entrepreneurship in general. I love marketing, sales. And so I created a mastermind alongside my business partner, Mike Zeller. And we just had one this past weekend. It was incredible. We flew in ClickFunnels. They came in, SMS instructors for learning how to scale that side. AppTrends that connects. That's how you can get from ClickFunnels into Shopify. They're the connection dot. And so we're basically bridging the gap from email, SMS, acquisition through funnels, and piecing it all together. So we've got entrepreneurs anywhere from 1 million to 25 million at this point. And we're putting like max caps at 25 people because we want it to be a small conservative group. And I want people to like not only learn from the instructors and who we fly in, but also to learn amongst the group and to be able to kind of grow each other. We've got our own Slack channel and I'm building out flows. I told you I got 800 plus email flows. So when I'm building stuff, testing it, scaling it, and ensuring that it works, I have no problem sharing that information with my guys. We can all be successful. Sure. I've even got guys that are technically competitors in this space because we're wall decor. So I got another guy that does canvases. And so, if it works for me, I know it'll work for him and I want him to be successful too. So there's plenty of room for everyone.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I am impressed with the growth. What's the website where people can find more about all the stuff that you're doing?
So it's redlinesteel.com. That's the name of my website. And we got all kind of cool things. I know I said my avatar is 35, 65 year old women, but we also have we have a man cave collection. We got incredible flags, patriotic stuff.
That's what I kind of, but the reason I laugh when you said this, because that's what I was envisioning, the more the man cave stuff. And when you said the third, I was like, what? It's like, it kind of threw me for a loop, you know? But listen, you are a true inspiration. Thank you for coming on. And after we're done, I want to talk to you about the veterans and stuff. So I really think that it's a really important thing to do. Get people great jobs. And there's nothing better than watching someone when they're like feeling like they're productive and making money and providing for themselves and those they love. It's just an incredible feeling watching that person and success that they have. And it's probably one of my highest values now, as I'm fortunate that I have so many people that have used my system of sales and persuasion, and it's really helped them become more effective as business people and certainly as salespeople. And whenever I go out and people come up to me, so that's probably one of the greatest feelings of all, for sure. That's the only greed I have left, is I'm greed for more people saying, wow, thank you, it was so great, your stuff, I got great values. I mean, that's the best feeling in the world, you know? So I think you're doing amazing stuff. Thanks so much for coming on. You're amazing. Again, thanks for the service to the country. And I have no doubt you will get to that $1 billion.
Thank you, brother.
Colin, thanks, buddy. Take care. Everybody, make sure you share this podcast with your friends. This is definitely something everybody needs to listen to on every level. Take care. God bless. All right, here's the deal. As America gets back to work, you want and need every possible advantage out there to succeed in the new economy. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud-based business system. So receive your free guide right now at netsuite.com/wolf. That is netsuite.com/wolf. All right, real quick, listen, if you're a CEO, you're a sales manager, or you're involved in hiring for your company, I want you to check out my new organization, Straight Line Hiring. What we do is we deliver expertly trained salespeople to companies like yours. World-class salespeople trained by me and delivered to you on demand. Go to my website, jordanbelfort.com. Check out Straight Line Hiring, the only way to grow your company with certainty.